You're listening to an audio resource from Redemption Hill Church. This resource is not meant to be a replacement for participation at a local church, but an accessory to the care you're receiving from your own pastors. To learn more about Redemption Hill Church or to give to our ministry, visit redemptionhilldsm.org.
Y'all have a king. It's just a matter of figuring out who it is. This is Cornfield Theology. All right, everyone, Pastor Sean here, back at you with another edition of Cornfield Theology, here with Pastor Chris Oswald from Providence Community Church, Lenexa, Kansas. I think last time I introduced you, I said Kansas City, and everyone in Kansas went nuts. Although, I guess you have, like, Kansas City, Kansas, too, right?
Yeah.
That's really confusing.
Yeah. I don't think it's...
What are we doing here?
Johnson County. Everybody says Johnson County around here.
Oh, really?
So, you know, I'm not from here, so I don't really care. They can call it whatever they want.
So, question for you. Are you in the South? Are we in the South right now?
No. You know, weirdly, so where I'm from is Jeff City, Missouri, which isn't really any further south than Kansas City, but it's in the middle of Missouri.
Okay.
That's the South. I think that's the South. Now, it's not, it doesn't, the Mason-Dixon line is the classic demarcation.
Right. Yeah.
But I grew up in a town where some people had Southern accents. I don't know how they got them.
Would you say you're Midwest?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do you know that Iowans around where I live, Des Moines Metro, and south of there, make fun of Missourians? What are you?
Probably think of them as like what we think of as Arkansas people.
Like IQ drops and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. I didn't realize that. I grew up in Eastern Iowa originally. Then I moved to the Twin Cities. And everyone in the Twin Cities made fun of people from Iowa. I was like appalled. I'm like, every joke was centered around how dumb we are. The only good thing going through Iowa
is... It's always the state south of you?
Yeah, I guess. You just keep moving south.
So what do the people in Antarctica do?
Where do they go? I guess if you keep going around.
Yeah, you keep going around. So it's those Russians or whatever. Those idiots in Greenland.
Yeah. So I don't think any less of you because you're in Kansas.
Thank you.
Not Missouri.
Yeah. Well, I'm from Missouri, so...
I just think less of you now. Well, thanks for joining the podcast. We've actually done a part one of a teleological argument of a super king. We went about 50 minutes, so we cut it off, decided to do part two for our listeners. So here's what I'd like you to do. In about 2 minutes or less, sum up part one for those who may have missed it. And I would just simply say, go and listen to it. If you'd like, you can listen to it in order, but at least go back to it. But sum up in 2 minutes or less, what part one's about and where's led us.
You can look at the history of the world and come up with a couple conclusions. First of all, people need someone in charge, and the people that we've had in charge don't cut it.
Yeah, they're flawed.
Yep, that's it. And so what we're seeing, so a teleological argument would say, well, that tells me that maybe something else is going on.
Yeah.
If the world keeps pointing to the need for something better than this, maybe that thing actually exists.
Right.
Maybe the world was created for this.
Right.
So
you had a little bit of apologetics in play, but you really wanted to go through the lens of political or theory.
Which, right? Yeah. So for me, I think maybe the unique thing here is just that I'm seeing political theory as a piece of philosophy that's just not been addressed well as it relates to politics.
Yeah. Yeah. When I read your stuff, I was like, wow, I haven't thought about, you know, my own understanding of who Christ is and him being a super king in this particular way, through this particular lens. So I found it really helpful talking through Rousseau and even Freud. I mean, getting to Freud, I guess, but Marx and then Thomas Hobbes and his Leviathan work, which kind of encapsulates where we were headed. And so we look out in the world, my friend. You know, I started voting, I think you said, was it 2000? Yeah. Was that the election?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Gore, you know who I voted for then?
You probably voted for Gore.
I did. I grew up in a democratic socialist family. Like they were democratic.
Did y'all just sit around with your mittens on?
Yeah, that is the meme going on right now. But to my family's credit, my parents in particular, they made it cool before Bernie Sanders made it cool.
Yeah. Now where were you? Eastern Iowa.
Eastern Iowa, Dubuque. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's some. Was it Union thing mostly?
My parents are hippies, man.
Okay. So there's the Catholic thing, which can go that direction.
Yeah, they're Catholic.
Catholic. There's a Catholic thing. Yeah, there's a bunch of different factors where you'll find those people, especially like Iowa.
Iowa's a weird.
Iowa is weird.
Yeah. Well, you know, they take pride in being the first caucus or primary, right?
Yeah, they did such a great job of it this year.
No, that was the Democratic Party who messed that up. Republicans did fine. And I'm not making a statement of, you know, for or against, but everyone like says Iowa's horrible. Well, it was actually the DNC who botched the caucuses.
Yeah, they hadn't got the Dominion voting machines working right.
Hey, man, you got to lay off the QAnon stuff.
Release the Kraken.
Yeah. Oh, well, those few comments encapsulate 2020 going into 2021. What a mess.
Oh, boy.
But let me say this. Well, one, I was politically awesome because everyone's well-informed.
You know who I've been getting into? Steve Deese. Do you know that guy?
Yeah.
Like, yeah. I just found him. I kind of enjoy him.
He's an Iowa boy.
Yep. Yeah.
Anyway. He's super popular in the area.
Yeah.
But no one's here to really listen to us talk about Iowa, as much as I could do that all day and love talking about the great things about the motherland, the Corn Belt. This is Cornfield Theology, by the way.
Yep.
So, and I do live in the middle of a cornfield.
Is it GMO or non-GMO Cornfield Theology?
Well, if you're asking my wife, it would have to be non-GMO.
Okay. And you're like, I don't care.
Yeah, I don't care. Yeah. Essential oil.
Water. Is our theology GMO or non-GMO?
Yeah.
All right.
Well, all this, strangely enough, does lead us to what we were talking about in our last podcast. Actually, it doesn't lead us there at all. But we were talking about a super king. All these leaders we look at in the world of politics, Biden, Trump, Obama before him, like there are cultish segments that made these individuals or make these individuals a messiah. But the fact is, they're not. They're deeply flawed. And we're actually longing for something else, something more. And so as Christians, our perspective is it's Jesus. And so I wanted to talk about these particular distinctives that you kind of laid out, that Jesus is the super king, that whether you realize it or not, you're longing for that, right?
Correct.
Explain more of that.
So I have a pretty deep rootedness with C.S. Lewis, kind of learned a lot about thinking and theology and stuff from reading him.
Yeah.
Lewis was persuaded eventually that what kept Lewis from becoming a Christian for a long time was he could just see that this idea of a savior dying and being raised again. Lewis knew his mythology so well that he was able to say, but there have been many iterations of that prior.
Just like there's many iterations of a flood. We've talked about the idea of covenant in the last podcast, and that is, you know, all throughout antiquity.
Not just a Christian concept. So that really kept Lewis back. Like, he became a deist, but he just couldn't get over that whole idea. And it was Tolkien who eventually persuaded him that Jesus is the true myth about which all the other myths have spoken.
This is our Lord of the Rings plug.
Yeah.
All right.
So the idea for Lewis was, the watershed moment for Lewis was, what if there's this writer named God who writes in the ink of reality, and he's written the story in such a way as to point all of these lesser versions, these lesser stories, these lesser myths to the one true myth, which is Jesus.
Yeah.
And so in many respects, like Aragorn in Lord of the Rings, or just all sorts of the Corn King, which is an old pagan myth, all of these point to Jesus in a way. And so my argument is that God has been writing about God has been writing in the ink of reality in the world of politics as well.
Yeah.
And he keeps saying to us over and over again, you need a king, but these aren't the right one.
Yeah.
And I think that's actually the lesson of the Old Testament. I think the lesson of the Old Testament is over and over again.
They opined for a king, right? Give us a king. Okay, well, here you go. Here's Saul.
And they opined for the Son of Man who would bring them rest.
Right.
You know, and so there's this tension that's developing all throughout the Old Testament. Maybe one day we'll get this one man who can actually give us rest and freedom and redeem us and so on.
Yeah.
And then you'd get David and you're like, oh, goody, David's the guy.
Yeah,
and then
David's
not the guy. Yeah. You know, I just read Deuteronomy 24 yesterday, where God tells Moses to go to the Mount Nebo and die. That's a rough passage. And and God says, you know, go to Mount Nebo and die, for you will not enter the promised land because you've not kept faith with me. And you look at a guy like Moses and you think, Moses is probably the Messiah. You know, you work your way into Exodus a little bit, and you're like, Moses is probably the Messiah.
Totally.
It'll be reasonable to think that. Or David's probably the Messiah.
Oh, think about all that Moses did. You know?
Yeah, and then God says, no, you're not even going to get into the promised land.
Yeah.
So the tension that God uses is a teleological tension. So he's creating this idea of something needs to fill this need.
So are you arguing that in Deuteronomy 24, correct? That part of the point God is trying to make is that Moses is not the Messiah.
Yes.
And I'm going to actually hand this over to Joshua.
Yes. Yes. And I think he's doing that with all these other men. So it's interesting because there's a tension that begins immediately when Eve, I think it's with Seth, when Seth is born, she says, you know, God has given me a son. Mm-hmm. And I think that the language there, if I'm not mistaken, actually says the son. Mm-hmm. So she's already looking back at that proto-evangelion, you know, she's already looking back at this promise.
Genesis 3. Yeah.
3:16, right? The 3:15, 16.
15, yeah.
That there would be someone to come that would overthrow, you know, in a Jordan kind of Peterson kind of way, you know, overthrow the dragon, you know?
Yep.
And so I think all human history has been wired in that respect, and not just in the category of kings, but in every category, Jesus is the answer to everything. In the category of politics, it's just very clear that we have never had the leader that we need.
Right. We've had some good leaders, deeply flawed, like we talked about last time.
Right.
You got your Winston Churchill, who, you know, he was the guy for World War II in England, but
he was the guy for the moment, as David was for a moment.
Yes, exactly.
As Moses was for a moment. But all of these guys go to their graves and they go to their graves with some pretty deep flaws and some pretty deep foibles and so forth. So, yeah. So I came up with this list of kind of six distinctives that I thought were, these are six basic categories where kings in the past fail. And these are six basic categories where Jesus does not. So the first one is this idea of diverse excellencies. Jonathan Edwards, one of the most famous, one of my favorite quotes from Jonathan Edwards is that he says, we see in Jesus an admirable conjunction of diverse excellencies. Mm. And what he means by that is that in Jesus, you see qualities that shouldn't be together.
At the same time.
Yep. Same time, in perfect harmony.
Right. So you could have an earthly leader who has some excellent qualities, right?
For sure.
Like, go back to Churchill. He was courageous. Which is courageous, but he had a lot of foibles, so he couldn't hold them all at the same time. There's no earthly leader. But with Jesus, it's different.
Yes, so Churchill's a great example. Absolute courage, but also that courage winds up leading when the London smog sets in. Mm-hmm. In other moments in his political life as well, that very same courage got him into trouble because it wasn't complemented with humility, for instance. So Jesus doesn't have that problem. Jesus doesn't have strengths and weaknesses. He just has strengths and strengths.
No.
The opposite coin side of anything for Jesus is just good.
Yeah.
So Jesus is strong, and he's 1,000% strong. And then you flip the coin, you realize no compromise has been made. He's also 1,000% loving.
Yeah.
And this idea is that the world is so complex, people are so complex, situations are so complex, that you can't have someone who's simply a one-trick pony.
Yeah.
You've got to have someone who can do all of it,
yeah,
who can spin all of the plates. There have been moments where we recognize this as deeply beautiful. I remember when the Challenger space shuttle blew up, and Ronald Reagan, who at the time was known almost as like a cowboy and this cold warrior, I remember him embracing a little girl who had lost a parent in the Challenger space shuttle. And there are moments like that when you see them, when you see someone who transcends their natural proclivities, say, to strength and envelops weakness or love, gentleness at the same time. They're glorious. And know, it's like a perfect note has been struck and you know something divine or transcendent has occurred. And that's because we have been educated by God through the history of the world to know we need someone who is both strong and loving. We need someone who is both confident and humble.
Right.
So on and so forth. And that there's no one like that.
Yeah, it's not to say that we couldn't do that for ourselves, but it's still deeply flawed. Like, for example, in parenting, I want to be strong and courageous for my daughters, but there are times where I need to come low and let them cry on my shoulder. Right?
Yeah.
But I also know I'm deeply sinful. And so I think that would be the one category that I would put, like, this individual we talked about, this super king with all these diverse excellencies, like you said, is always good, right? And they're perfectly done. Unlike me, where I might have those moments, but then I get back up, you know, the next moment and I'm a moron, you know.
And those moments, I would argue, are gifts of God.
Absolutely.
They're not you anyway, you know?
Yeah.
So, honestly, leaders get to the point where they're capable of leading or where they're exalted into that position because they have had unbalanced strengths and people have recognized those. You know, no one elected Donald Trump because they thought he was a balanced human being.
Right.
You know? So there's almost a reward in the earthly system for someone who is entirely strong or entirely clever or so on and so forth.
Yeah.
Where those leaders themselves aren't even necessarily encouraged to become full orbed people anyway.
Right. And I would also say like there's a difference between, you know, a Christian approach to this and a non-Christian approach to this, where from a Christian approach, we want to become more like Christ and the what communicable attributes that do exist, right? We want to adopt those, but again, this goes back to my point. They're still deeply flawed.
Yeah.
Right? Deeply sinful.
So, you know, we talked about the Goldilocks effect in the last podcast, and I think there's a Goldilocks effect for leadership. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I'm still learning that. I've been a pastor for 25 years or something now, and I'm still like learning how to let the strength of Christ fill my weaknesses and how not to boast in my strengths and so on. So I'm learning gentleness and learning patience and those sorts of things. So, you know, in many respects, those that have had to walk with me through my leadership, like they could just very easily tell you, Chris is limited in these ways.
Things, yeah.
And that's going to affect your capacity as a leader. Those limitations are going to affect you. They are compromises. They're less thans. And so the glorious idea that Jesus doesn't have any of those.
Yeah. You know, and then our weakness actually is a good thing because that's when we see our deep need for Christ.
Yeah.
So that's good. So there's a diverse excellencies of Christ, right?
Yeah.
So what would be the second one?
So the idea there teleologically is we really need someone totally well-rounded and we don't have anybody. Mm. So maybe there's somebody out there like that. And the second one is like that. And it would say that really there hasn't been a successful leader who has successfully united diverse ethnicities. So we're talking about diverse excellencies. Now let's talk about diverse ethnicities. This capacity to unite people of different cultures and ethnicities. Mm. We all know that we want that. We want to see that. We all know that that's really almost necessary if you're going to have some kind of extended period of peace. But cultures being what they are themselves dividing walls of hostilities.
So we see in Christ the diversity of a nationality, race, even language, background, whatever. So we think about Revelation, right? We think about heaven,
right?
What's heaven going to be like? It is a beautiful diversity.
Yeah, and that's built into that Daniel 7 passage, by the way. That you know he is going to be the king over all the languages and you know,
right. It's also everything. Revelation 7:9. After this, I looked up and behold, a great multitude that no one could number from every nation, from all tribes and peoples and languages.
Right.
Standing before the throne and before the Lamb.
Yep. So that's the idea there that there's just a diverse number of excellency or diverse ethnicities, and so one of the things I saw this summer with all the racial difficulties and just the church
tension,
it rose to preeminence within the conversation of the church.
Yep.
One of the things I saw was a astonishing lack of faith and celebration. Or just realization that the entire story of the book of Acts is about unfolding and uniting racial tensions.
Oh, yeah.
That the whole,
tensions.
Yeah,
and
the whole story. Like it seemed like that whole experience in the summer, for those that did look back, they only looked back to see the negative.
Yeah.
But let me go back 2,000 years and I'm preaching through Acts 10 and 11 right now.
Yeah.
When
Cornelius,
Jews,
right?
Yeah,
yeah.
The Jews were legitimately astonished that someone who was not an ethnic Jew could be saved.
Right.
Now, that would not astonish me. I don't think it would astonish you.
No.
So we made some progress. But the point being that Jesus has done more for ethnic healing
100%
than anything else I know about.
Right. And you know, even when you get to Acts 15, you got the Jerusalem Council. This is where Peter's going to Jerusalem to be like, guys, I need you to settle this once and for all.
Right.
And then we have places like the book of Galatians, which also is really building out justification by faith, but basically saying this is for Jew and Gentile, right?
And they were like they were struggling with that.
Yeah,
they,
absolutely.
They were like, well, hold on. I mean, obviously the whole story of Galatians, which you preached. Was that one of your first
books of the Bible?
Books. And like that whole deal is just this, the Judaizers coming to spy out our liberty and this confidence that like, no, the gospel can't really be for everybody.
And I don't want to, you know, go into too much of a tangent here, but I will say this in terms of what we saw in the summer of 2020, the best response to what we saw is the gospel.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I've made the statement before, I've done two podcasts on why I'm not woke. I'm not trying to be controversial. I'm just trying to say there's actually a better way, a better filter, a better means in which we can understand what we see and figure out how to apply the tension that exists.
Yeah.
It's through the super king that we're talking about right now.
Exactly. So another example, another one of these excellencies or reasons why I think politically we're needing someone like Jesus is you need to be able to unite people that are already in existing systems.
Yeah.
So you need this capacity to sort of unite individuals that are practicing in existing systems. So for instance, again, back to the book of Acts, you've got Pharisees who are saved. You've got, you've got different kinds of Jews saved.
And then you've got
Roman soldiers saved. Yeah,
Greek philosophers and
on. What's interesting is that, I mean, with the exception of a couple, like for instance, the idol builders in Acts, what chapter is that? In Ephesus.
Acts 20.
Yeah. So they're out of work. Their job is, the prostitutes have to stop prostituting.
Right.
You know, there are a few jobs, there are a few positions where you've got to let go.
Yep.
But you don't really have to do that most of the time if you follow Jesus. Most of the time, there is a Christ-centered way to be a Roman soldier, mm-hmm. or there's a Christ-centered way to be a rabbi or whatever.
A politician.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And so one of the interesting things about this super king idea is that you could follow Jesus whether you are in Iowa or in Missouri, whether you're a male or a female, whether you live in Africa or England. We can all have the same super king. And I think that's a very interesting idea because we've all been talking about for years and years this new world order and this idea of globalism and so on.
Yeah.
And I think that the desire there is legitimate. It's the desire for multinational commerce and agreement and peace and predictability and so forth. I think all that actually makes sense. I just don't think it's going to come through capitalism.
Right.
It's going to come through Christ.
Now, would you say that there are some political systems that are contrary to Christian ideas and values and the acknowledgement of a super king?
I think obviously communism is deeply contrary to these things.
Yeah. It's not to say Christians can't exist in that.
That's the other thing though. Yeah.
Right.
So I think probably Rome. Yeah, I think probably Rome was deeply contrary to being a Christian until Christianity just changed Rome from the inside out.
Yeah.
And so my guess is that you could see a day when there are Christians in the Communist Party in China, perhaps, or something crazy like that, and you could see the system change from the inside out.
And what you see in these situations where they're just wrestling with, okay, what does it mean to be this and this?
Right.
Excuse me.
So I think capitalism is a decent example of when an idea unites people. Because now, we're probably not going to go to war with China. We have too much invested in this common value called capitalism.
Right.
Yeah. And so what if that common value was Christ? Well, you could see China staying China and Africa staying Africa. And I speak of Africa that way. It's not really right. I mean, Zambia staying Zambia.
Yeah.
And,
Uganda or whatever.
Yeah. You could see the whole world trading on their common love for Christ.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is the idea. So my son and I were talking about how 100 years ago, we didn't know about germs or whenever it was. And now there's this idea that germs exist and it's transformed our entire society. This notion of something that none of us see, but it's an idea and we believe it. And it's actually changed the world for the better. Now, there are some people who have taken it too far and so on. And we're seeing that this year. But this idea that an invisible idea, the sense that an invisible idea could literally transform the world because everybody just decided it was true. Well, what if everybody just decided that Jesus is really king?
Yeah.
What would that do? Well, it's already happening. This has been happening for 2,000 years.
You're such a post-millennialist.
it really has already started happening.
You're my favorite post-millennial friend.
Which is someone great. Once told me, I preached a sermon on Ezra. They're like, that's the best sermon on Ezra I've ever heard. I was like, that's the only sermon on Ezra you've ever heard. So when you say I'm your best post-millennial friend, I know, like, I'm your only post-millennial friend.
Hey, I got other friends.
Not any post-millennial. Anyway, you're going to be your own best post-millennial friend one day.
Yeah, someday we'll get there. I'll see the light. So those are the two distinctive qualities so far: diverse excellencies, diverse ethnicities. What's the third one?
You know, I don't have those in front of me. Do you have them?
The dual citizenship.
Yeah, that's the one I just talked about.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
And then the problem with morality and positive negative liberty.
Let's get to that last.
Okay. And then what about dominion through denial?
This is so beautiful. Okay. This is so beautiful. Don't ever trust a truth system that doesn't explicitly want to take over the world. And this is why amillennialism is crap. Because... because
I feel like I got to defend myself now.
No, you can't. Here's what I mean by that. Every truth system should want to take over the world. Everyone should explicitly own to that. The Muslims should say, we want to take over the world. The wokes should say, we want to take over the world. The Christians should say, we want to take over the world.
Say the wokes?
The wokes, yeah.
The wokes?
The wokes. The woke
crowd?
Woke. By the way, if Islam takes over the world, it's going to look a certain way.
Yeah.
And if woke people take over the world, it's going to look like Islam. So anyway, but the point is like, don't trust a truth system that doesn't claim to want to dominate. Doesn't see, that's the funny thing about this idea of dominion. It's baked in to the gospel. We ignore it.
It's no, I'm with REM here. Was it REM? Everybody, it's the end of the world.
No, Tears for Fears. It. Everybody wants and to rule the world. Anyway, but here's the crazy thing. Christianity has the most incredible idea of how to do that.
Yeah.
And it's ascendancy through death.
Yes.
It's die to yourself. So how does Jesus take over the world? And how does Caesar take over the world? And how does Muhammad take over the world?
Yeah.
Jesus takes over the world by dying.
Yeah.
And so this
in particular, like sacrificial death.
Yeah.
I mean, he put his own life on the line for others.
Exactly. Yeah. And so that's every system, every true system should have dominion as their goal. They should want to take over the world. Otherwise, like maybe what you believe isn't true. If you don't think it's true, then So if you want, but here's the thing, every other power system that I can think of, every other thought process or political system or whatever, it's all through self-exaltation. It's all by pushing someone else down so I can get up higher.
Yeah.
And then Jesus comes along and he says, I'm going to die for you.
Yeah.
And that's going to actually cause me to be king of the world. So now I have a new vision for leadership looks like in my church, what leadership looks like in my workplace,
in the home,
what leadership looks like with my wife.
Yeah.
You know, people freak out when they see this idea of biblical submission and biblical headship. That's because they're importing a different understanding
of submission, different meanings of submission and headship. They just don't know what it means biblically.
In particular, they're used to leaders who lead by pushing people down.
Right.
They're not used to leaders who lead by dying to themselves.
Right.
And now there are so many Christian men who use that as a load of crock.
Every good thing is
they're not. But the truth is that this idea that Jesus could actually be the king of all the kings, because he's found a unique way. Well, he didn't find it, of course, but he has delivered a unique way of ascendancy, a unique way of taking control. And that is by giving up control and dying to self. And it was encoded in the garden when we were surrounded by all these seeds, these seed bearing things.
Yeah.
And Jesus eventually says, like, you know, if you live to yourself, that's it. But if you want to really do something, you know, fall to the ground and die like a seed, and then you'll bear much fruit.
This is why the sacrament of baptism is so beautiful, because we get a picture of that as well.
That's right.
Right? You see this, I'm dying to self, and you die to yourself, and you realize I am sacrificing something and gaining everything, which is everything being Christ.
Yeah, and so this is you know, we've talked about how 2020 has been such a difficult year for pastors.
Oh, yeah.
But in many respects, I think all that the Lord has done is just say, okay, you know, you want to be in the Jesus stuff still? Well, you got to do the Jesus leadership, and that is you got to die to yourself.
Yeah.
And it's hard.
Die to yourself in terms of your own ideas and wants and desires for COVID, right? Or politics, or in the, you know, with your wife, or
die to yourself. Your husband. Die to yourself in the desire for your church to grow in a year that it probably won't. Yeah, die to yourself in the desire to make
that happen.
And die to yourself in the desire to make all. So a lot of us are in ministry because we like making people happy.
Yeah.
Well, this is not the year for that.
That is not the year. Yeah, you made everyone mad.
Yeah. So not to go on a tangent there, but I just think that's so beautiful that I'm convinced about all this. Like, I could talk about this for hours and hours, but I think it's beautiful to realize that Jesus is just as open and honest about wanting to take over the world as anybody else ever has been. But his plan about doing, his way of doing it is the cross.
Yeah.
And not to put other people on the cross, to put himself on the cross, yeah. Right? Like the Romans used the cross the one way, Jesus used. So Jesus differentiates fundamentally about leadership. And he says, don't be like the Gentiles who lord it over each other. You know, if you want to become great, become less.
This really gets to like what makes Jesus the super king.
Right.
It's not only how he led. He confirmed what he also said. Like, I'm going to do this and I'm going to show you. And now I want you to go do the same.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's the other crazy thing. You know, you don't call your follower. If you're trying to establish some kind of like army of people, you tell them what's in it for them. And you tell them like, hey, if you follow me,
this will happen.
Then I'll get you promoted and so on and so forth. And Jesus says, you know, if you want to be my disciple, you have to take up your cross and follow me as I take up my cross. And why would anyone do that? It's because this is the, well, let's transition to the positive negative liberty thing here, because this is the whole thing. That's the most powerful cause or call for the super king is no one else can make people want to be good. There's something unique going on with Jesus that any other king can't touch. He can't get into our hearts. And this is the other thing, just quickly about dominion. The only land, like Jesus, if he's God, and obviously we believe he's God. If Jesus is God, like he owns everything anyway, you know.
Right.
Missouri's his, and so is Iowa.
Yep.
But as far as you can see in Scripture, the only territory he ever really demands is a person's heart.
Yeah.
And that's the one territory that no king can ever get to. Yeah. It's every king wants it. You know, Nebuchadnezzar wants Daniel to worship him. He's not okay with Daniel just like doing what he's supposed to.
Right.
He wants Daniel to love him. Daniel's not going to love him. Right. Every king wants to be loved. But Jesus is like, that's all he wants. It's like, I just want your heart. I want to rule your heart.
Yeah.
So his whole plan for ruling the world isn't to rule territory or nations or borders. His territory, his plan for ruling the world is to rule a bunch of Chinese hearts and American to rule a bunch of Polish hearts and American hearts. And that's his plan. And it's happening.
So talk more.
It's happening, Sean.
It's getting better. Really?
Just not here.
Not in 20. So how does a post mill reconcile 2020? Never mind. So can you explain more positive rights?
Okay.
Or positive liberty? Do you remember?
I feel like this is a big deal. So I don't know, like it's going to take a minute to unpack this.
Yeah.
So, okay. So you've got positive liberty and negative liberty. And that's a school of philosophy as well. Not everyone would talk about it in that way. But I believe the Christian kind of worldview presents freedom in that light. Mm-hmm. So there are two kinds of freedom.
So you use the word liberty. I use positive, negative rights. So, but I think we're talking about the same thing.
So I would say liberty or freedom may be better only in the sense that what we're asking is almost Hobbesian in that sense of your ability to do what you want to do, but rights is.
So you're not as much looking at this from a constitutional perspective. Right. This is what the Constitution said. I would say the Constitution exists to protect our negative rights, and that's what it's there for. That's how it was written. You're looking at this through more political theory in general and then tying it to Christianity. So maybe liberty and freedom is a better word.
Also, because there's really no such thing as positive rights would be, as we'll see in a moment, that'd be difficult to talk about that way. Positive freedom. So let me just go through it and see what you think. Okay. Yeah. So negative liberty is the absence of obstacles or barriers or constraints. So if you're driving down the road and you come to a left or a right turn,
right,
and you can choose either way because no one's preventing
you. No one's being affected but me. I can choose to go left. I can choose to go right. It doesn't affect you in any way.
There is no group of mostly peaceful protesters,
right,
making you turn left or right.
Mostly peaceful
protesters. You can turn left or right if you want to turn left or right. So that's negative freedom. Now we hear the word negative and we think of it as negative.
That's really not.
Yeah. But it's really just this idea that no one's restraining you. No one's keeping you from doing anything.
Does this have like a libertarian sensibilities here?
It does. One of the better articles on this subject is written on a blog called Stasios, and it's on Christianity and Libertarianism.
Okay.
And I would say that libertarianism is probably the most Christian, the most native Christian political theory that's not explicitly Christian. But right. Negative freedom. I want to turn left or I want to turn right. I can. So most of the Ten Commandments have a negative value. Just don't do this one thing, Sean. Don't kill, you know. You can do anything you want. Just don't do this thing or that thing. And of course, negative freedom was really the freedom of the Garden of Eden. You know, do everything you want. Just don't do this one thing. So it's the idea that more or less you have freedom to do whatever you would like to do. The government, according to Romans 13, is given charge to protect negative freedom.
Yeah, Romans 13:1, 1 right. Peter 4.
So the government is basically supposed to make sure that when I get down to the end of that road, turn right or left, I have that freedom to turn right or left. And they can use a sword, which is the only instrument the government's been given by God. They can use a sword to do that, meaning they arrest the mostly peaceful protesters, and so that I can turn right or left and so on. And they use a sword to do that. Now, imagine that you're driving down the road and you can turn left or right, but you kind of have to turn left because you're addicted to cigarettes.
Right. And you have to go that way to get the cigarettes.
Yeah. The Quick Trip or whatever is to the left, and you got to get them Virginia Slims. I know if I was going to smoke cigarettes, I'd go Virginia Slims menthols, I think.
I would have no idea. I have no category.
Yeah. I think that's the most girly cigarette you can get is a Virginia Slim.
Is it really?
Okay. Yeah, I think so.
I just know Marlboro. Marlboro?
Marlboro. Okay. Marlboro. Man, we're so...
Don't you know how much I know.
We're so churchy, we don't even know how to say Marlboro. Marlboro. This is terrible.
I just know he's a cowboy.
Anyway, so imagine you're at the fork of the road, and you could turn left or right, but you have the negative freedom to do that, but you are addicted to cigarettes, so you have to turn left. So now the freedom that you lack isn't something from that's coming from the outside. It's coming from the inside. Well, what do you do about that? Because that's actually most of the time the real problem in life. The real problem in life isn't the people that are preventing me from going left or right. It's me preventing me from being able to choose this thing or that thing. Now, if you start saying that the government has a role there, things get really weird really fast, and we'll get into this in a moment. Yeah. But this is a very important issue, and it's why it turns to libertarianism, because if I, as the king, decide I'm going to pay for everybody's health care, that's nice of me. But what if, like, you're addicted to cigarettes?
Right.
So do I still pay for your health care?
Yeah, my health care costs are a lot higher.
Do I let you just die of lung cancer on the street?
Yeah.
Well, if I decide to just let you die of lung cancer on the street, then everybody else's freedoms are protected, but you're dying of lung cancer. Right. Yeah. It's kind of a gross thing and kind of cruel, or maybe. So now I have this, I seem to have this built-in incentive to want to be able to control your habits.
Right.
Because once I've agreed to extend something to you that's beyond negative freedom, see, giving you healthcare isn't protecting your negative freedom. It's trying to give you positive freedom.
Right. Yep.
Once I decide to do that, now I've got a foothold in your life.
Yeah, so positive rights would be like healthcare for all or some type of welfare system. Anything that you're giving as a result or the consequence of something else that is being done over here.
Yeah. Yeah. So now I've got this ownership of Sean's habits. And I can actually say, by the way, I'm just giving you some of the money that I took in taxes from the rest of the citizens. So mm-hmm. I can tell the whole citizenry, we all have an interest in getting Sean to stop smoking.
So here, let me ask you this, because I got a lot of liberal friends. And they'll push back to me and say, well, don't you care about the health of that person who's smoking? And government is a means in which we can care for them. Why don't you care for that person in this particular way? You know what I'm saying? Like, I mean, people have listened to this podcast. They know I got some libertarian sensibilities. I'm not shy about that. But I'm also well aware that those arguments do exist. Like, how come I don't care? Why not just pay a little more in my taxes so that more people can get the health care they need? In particular, those who are just drinking too many sodas, for example, right? So their blood sugar is through the roof, or they have a heart disease because they don't eat well. What's wrong with that?
So I think that liberals in particular have trouble with these concepts because they actually don't really value freedom. So I think it's hard for them to see me brainwashing you.
Right.
So let's say you're addicted to cigarettes, but I'm going to still pay your bills. But I got to try at least to get you to quit smoking. So then I start like incepting you with advertising and I get your kids at school, at the school that I run.
Yeah.
And I'm like, you know, if your daddy smokes, like he could die. So tonight when you get home, make sure you tell your daddy to stop smoking.
Right.
And so on. And then, so on and so forth. I could build a system that would basically take away your freedom to choose.
Okay.
And that would be, in a conservative perspective, far more cruel than letting you die of cancer.
Okay.
So I think the big divergence is that conservatives have this value of negative freedom where they say, I want to be left alone. And liberals say, I want someone to daddy me and lead me and care for me. So I think if a liberal were to find out, if a progressive were to find out that I created a school system, like a curriculum, to teach your kids that smoking's bad so they can get you to quit smoking. And then I raised cigarette tax, you know, $2 a pack.
Right.
And then I also, before the NASCAR, you know, thing event that you went to, let's dive into the stereotype all the way. I gave a PSA. I paid for there to be on the Jumbotron a big thing against smoking and so on. Yeah. So I'm basically hounding you passively about smoking.
Yeah.
Well, to a liberal, they would say, that's great. That's wonderful. So let's do that with, what if we decided that homosexuality produces too much disease?
Right.
Let's deal with homosexuality too.
Yeah.
So everybody has a line where
they do.
If suddenly we begin to say, you know, the risk factors for HIV from engaging in homosexual behavior, risk factors for a number of STDs from engaging in homosexual behavior are so high, they're far higher than COVID fatality rates. So let's go ahead and start requiring condoms. Now, let's not just suggest them, let's require them. And maybe more than that, let's just do a full-blown quarantine so that no homosexual behavior can take place.
Sure.
Well, suddenly those that were so ardently for government intervention into liberties are suddenly like, whoa, back off, big brother.
Yeah. Orwellian type of thing going on, yeah.
So I think it just requires, we all have these things, and here I would say, a homosexual libertarian is my ally on this particular point. We all have this sort of agreement. It's like, there are things that I want to choose, that I want to have the freedom to choose, that I don't want the government investing in. And yes, some of those behaviors are more risky than others, but I don't want the government involved. Well, then the answer has to be, if you don't want the government educating you and lecturing you and controlling your behaviors, then you gotta not ask, then they can't pay for your mistakes.
Right.
So the only way to shrink government is the only way to get government out of our lives is to just agree we're going to have to deal with some consequences.
So how does this lead us to Christ?
Because, and this is the whole super king thing, the terminus of that whole idea, we're not left in an indefinite kind of, well, that just sucks. I guess some of us are just going to smoke cigarettes and so on. Yeah. well, no, we actually have someone, Jesus, who can change our appetites. Mm. So back to Hobbes and the state of nature, we have a savior that actually changes our nature. Mm. And so now we have a government that is practical and but limited. We have a physical government, practical and limited, but we have a king who is over that king. We have a king that's over Biden or over Trump, and he will actually can and will and does routinely for thousands of years change people's desires.
Yeah.
And
he gets at the heart.
He rules the heart.
Yeah.
And so Jesus is ruling sovereignly over all things, and he's in charge of whoever's the president today. But he's also ruling in all the small things, and he's actually like helping guys like us stop wanting to smoke or stop wanting to drink too much or maybe go out for a walk and not be so fat anymore or whatever.
Right, yeah.
He's doing that stuff. He's making men into better fathers. He's making women into better mothers. He's doing all the heart transformation. The great difficulty anticipated by the founding fathers was this will all fail if people aren't good.
Yeah.
Because they were prescribing a limited government that would require people to self-govern themselves, you know, morally through Christ.
Right.
So that's where it leads to Christ.
That's fascinating. That's a great discussion, starting with Rousseau and, you know, getting to Hobbes and leading us to the greatest king, super king.
And I really feel like the church has a unique role to play because we have a sword. We can, you know, exercise church discipline and so forth. But we also have like a tool to build lives. Mm-hmm. And the government can't build lives. I read recently William Wilberforce said of the poet, William Cooper. Wilberforce said that the school system oppressed Cooper. He was a sensitive guy.
Okay.
And Wilberforce said it was like an iron glove picking up a flower.
Oh, wow.
And I think that's when the government tries to change things. The government's just a sword. That's all it is. The government's just a sword. When they try to cultivate or care or nurture, they just destroy stuff.
Yeah.
But the church can actually do those things.
Right. That's great. Well, thank you, man. We're about 46 minutes into this one. So that's part two. And so if you want to listen to part one, you go back to part one. And so Jesus is the super king. He is the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords. We see it in Daniel. And then we see it obviously going back into the Gospels and through Acts all the way to the book of Revelation, which you should be an amillennialist. Thanks everyone for listening. You can check out all the other podcasts on YouTube or on all the relevant podcast outlets as well. You can go to redemptionhilldsm.org to see all the podcasts and everything we're putting out in terms of content. That's it for now. Thanks everyone. God bless and peace out. Until next time. Bye.